Welcome back to Coastal Connection. I'm Brian Russo. We talked a lot on this show, especially in the past few months, about the relationship between farmers and environmentalists and how the two sides often don't see eye to eye about the role agriculture plays in the health of the Chesapeake Bay. Well, today we're going to look at a potential solution to that long-running dispute, a solution built around wood chips. The Midshore Riverkeeper Conservancy this week installed a wood chip bioreactor on a farm in Queen Anne, Maryland. Now, if you're wondering what the heck a wood chip bioreactor is, well, it's basically an underground system that collects water from farmland before it goes into rivers and filters it through a pile of wood chips. And those wood chips are home to tiny bacteria that love to eat nitrate, the very pollution that can create algae blooms and dead zones in the bay. So when the bacteria do their thing, the cleaner water makes its way into local waterways, and everyone is happy. At least that's the theory. I wanted to see how this process works for myself. So this week I swung by the installation of that wood chip bioreactor in Queen Anne. And I talked to this guy.
My name is Drew Coslow, and I'm the Choptank Riverkeeper.
So tell me a little bit about where we are. We're in Centerville, Maryland. We are in a huge farm. This is the Mason Heritage Farm. Tell me a little bit about this place and what this wood chip bioreactor is.
Okay, well, Bill, I would say, is a very progressive thinker among farmers. He's converted his farm. I think about 70% of his home farm is organic. A lot of his cover crops are kind of alternative cover crops to with a goal of fixing nitrogen using plants like clover and others that fix nitrogen. In other words, they take nitrogen out of the atmosphere and bring it into the plant. And that way he can reduce his fertilizer inputs. He relies on things like poultry litter and getting nitrogen out of the air to grow his crops.
We have been talking on our program for the past several months about the relationship between environmental groups and farmers and that quest to reduce runoff waste into our waterways mm-hmm. here in our region. Of course, several months ago, there was a lot of talk about that phosphorus management tool. That has since been pulled back on. But, you know, the larger conversation is what farmers can do to use that poultry waste or use waste in general on their farm as fertilizer. Tell me what this wood chip bioreactor does and how that plays into that greater goal.
A lot of farms on the Eastern Shore have drain tile networks or drainage ditch networks to remove excess water and allow them to get onto their fields in the springtime. This farm is no exception, as is the other farm where we installed one of these bioreactors. And what we're doing is taking advantage of the water collection system, whether it's the ditch or, in these cases, the drain tile network. And we're running that water through a natural filter.
And now, that's the wood chips.
That's the wood chips. So the wood chips provide an environment for bacteria that eat the nitrate, which is the mobile form of nitrogen, out of the water. And they convert it to nitrogen gas, which is 70% of the air we breathe. And the beauty of it is that it's a natural process. It occurs in first-order streams like this one we see right in front of us. Mm-hmm. The contact the water has with woody vegetation, with plant material in the floodplain, that's where you get your nutrient processing. So what we're doing is putting that into a confined area, the wood chip pit, and running our water through and trying to keep as long a retention time of the water in the wood chips as we can. And each site is going to be a little site-specific, but in Iowa, where these things were developed, they found to be very effective at removing nitrate, relatively inexpensive to put in the ground, edge-of-field technology, so you don't take land out of production, and very low maintenance over their lifespan, which is between 15 and 30 years.
In looking at this farm, this is a huge space. And what we're looking at here, this particular site where we're, you know, you guys are installing this reactor, is seemingly a drop in the bucket of land space, comparatively speaking. Tell me about what impact, and I guess what sort of success rates you're seeing on a project like this on a farm of this scale.
This project is going to treat about 60 acres of land that drains through this drain tile network. The cost to install it's about $19,000, including our design. We got to thank the Maryland Department of Natural Resources for providing the money for us to do this. We're just excited because we think this is going to be a viable tool for Maryland farmers to use to help them meet their goals under their TMDLs and local WIPs and watershed implementation plans. Our group, Midshore Riverkeepers, sees our role as trying to help farmers, you know, as being part of the same community. And I know, you know, each waterkeeper group has a different approach. Ours is, at the moment, is to try to be collaborative. We feel like, as difficult as it is, as hard, as uncomfortable as the relationship is between environmental groups and farmers, it's in each of our best interests to try to work together, try to develop practices that are going to work, to do the monitoring, to get them accepted as part of the Maryland Cost Share Program, as part of the approved EPA best management practices, so that we have tools, so that we give farmers tools to help them meet our goals.
Yeah. You mentioned that this was developed in Iowa. I know that farms in California are also using this technology as well. Mm-hmm. When did your group, the Midshore Riverkeeper Conservancy, find out about it, and when did you realize that it could be something that could work here in Maryland?
I learned about these wood chip bioreactors about a little more than a year ago, and was instantly drawn to the technology because of how simple it is. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, what you're doing is mimicking the same processes that occur in first order streams, and that's what makes it simple and inexpensive, and it's the beauty of the project. You know it's going to work because it happens in nature.
Right.
And that's what really, so right as soon as I learned about it, I knew it was something that we could adapt to the Eastern Shore. And I was just really excited to have a couple of farmers who were willing to be guinea pigs, basically.
Right. And that's what's interesting, because as you said, it's a seemingly inexpensive solution to the larger problem of waste management.
Right.
on the family farm or the corporate farm. Was the hardest sell just getting local farmers to wrap their head around a new sort of solution? Or was it a little more layered than that, going back to that sort of tension between environmentalists and farmers? Were farmers less apt to listen to you, you know, because it was an environmental group bringing a possible solution to the table?
It was certainly complex. We've been working over at Oakland View Farm, which is where we installed the other bioreactor, for about 3.5 years. And building trust with a farmer, working collaboratively with the local soil conservation districts, with the Natural Resources Conservation Service, the typical ag agencies that are installing and approving and designing these BMPs, so that everybody was vetted with the process, knew about the projects, and was on board before we decided to go forward. So building that consensus for the first one took time. And that once we had a plan to go forward with that one, we got it was slightly easier with Bill Mason here at Mason's Heritage.
Let's talk a little bit about numbers as far as if a farmer is looking at this and hearing about this sort of waste solution or technology, you know, what sort of ballpark goals could they look at as far as, you know, removing nitrates and filtering through their water systems?
What we've seen and what the research shows is that these practices can be or have an efficiency rating between 20% nitrate removal and 90%. And the wetter the system is that you're putting the system into, the bioreactor into, the more removal. The higher the nitrate levels in the water coming to your pit, the higher your removal rates mm-hmm. are going to be. So at Oakland View, you know, you have a large dairy operation, and they're generating a lot of waste material. They're running it through their irrigation rig. So there are plenty of nitrates there. And we expect that system to be very efficient. We're very excited to have another farm to test the project on, because this is a very different kind of operation here at Mason's Heritage, and we're going to be collecting data on a monthly basis, providing it to the state, to the MDA, and to our conservation districts so that they have the information they need to kind of move forward with seeing how adaptable it is to other farms.
Yeah. If this sort of technology becomes mainstream here on the shore, you know, let's say in the next decade, more and more farmers are utilizing this. How much impact do you think that that is going to make on the larger issue of keeping clean waterways in the Chesapeake Bay and improving that relationship between environmentalists and farmers?
The potential difference that this kind of project can make is really large. And the beauty of it is it's a one-time installation and you let the project do its job. Cover crops are a very efficient way at removing nitrate, but you have to reapply them every year, and sometimes your weather conditions will prohibit you from doing that. This kind of project, you put it in the ground, you do your monitoring. As soon as you see your efficiencies drop, your performance of the project drop, you can excavate out your wood chips and replace them, and you're back up to the design efficiency of your project. As far as the relationships with the ag community, you know, it can't get worse.
That's true.
I mean, in all honesty, they're in defense mode, full defense mode right now, and that was evident with a phosphorus management tool that just came out. But hopefully, you know, this is a step forward in mending those relationships and building new relationships. Mm. And, you know, I think the more... I've been saying this, I've been in the business for 20 years, and I've always said, if you want to see what a polluter looks like, look in the mirror. And in my mind, we're all in this together, and the more collaboration, particularly between groups that are typically adversarial, you know, the more collaboration you get, the better.
It's been said to me before that there's not one solution that anyone's going to come up with that's going to fix all of the problems of waste management here on the shore. Do you think this is part of the solution?
I think it has the potential to be. Again, you know it's going to work, and you know it's a relatively inexpensive fix, and it has that potential to really make a difference. Again, it's another tool, and that's what we like about it.
That was Drew Coslow. He's the Choptank Riverkeeper, talking with me at the Mason Heritage Farm in Centerville, Maryland. To learn more about the wood chip bioreactors and their role in reducing waste from our waterways, head to our website, wamucoast.org. We finished today's show at the zoo in Salisbury. And unless you've been on holiday somewhere tropical, you've likely felt the cold sting of winter weather that has chilled our region for the past few weeks. But animals living at the zoo can't just throw on a sweater when the temperature drops. That's where zookeepers like Caleb Oliver come in. This week, he showed me what it takes to get these animals through the cold months by taking me to a very small spot just off the beaten path at the zoo.
Well, right now, it's in normally our quarantine room, but it's doubling as a winter holding for our more cold-sensitive animals. So it's basically just about a 20 by 25-foot room with some caging in it that we can retrofit to accommodate the different types of species that might need to be held in here over the colder parts of the year.
So what's in here right now? We're looking at two iguanas, and I know there's some turtles over here in a bin as well. Tell me about these animals.
Right now we have our male and female iguanas, which would normally be in our sloth exhibit, and then we have a gopher tortoise and a red-eared slider, which is more of an aquatic turtle, and they all need to be kept in warm conditions.
Now when they're taken out of the habitat where they usually spend the majority of the year in, and they're put in this sort of quarantine or just winter holding environment, what changes for them? Does it have a huge impact on them as far as, you know, existing in their so-called natural habitat?
It can, actually. It really depends on the animal. We try to pull animals off exhibit sort of as a last resort. We try to make every accommodation that we can in the exhibit, but some animals just don't adjust to those accommodations. Birds are a pretty good example. We have a couple of birds that some years we leave them on exhibit year-round, but in the more severe winters we're forced to pull them, and they behaviorally don't always adjust that well to the change, but it's something that we have to do out of necessity. Some animals, when they are shocked with a change like that, will stop eating. The dry air indoors can often create skin conditions, things like that. So these are all additional challenges that we're faced when we have to house animals indoors.
Let's go back to the birds for a moment, because, you know, of course, anybody who's been to the Salisbury Zoo, when you walk in, the exhibit of pink flamingos is very prevalent. It sticks out in people's minds. How do those birds and other birds in the park fare during winter cold snaps like this?
It really depends on the species and the individual behavior. The flamingos, for example, actually do very well in the winter. They use the circulation in their legs and the constant water temperature in their pools, which have circulating water, to maintain body temperature. And because of their natural history being from the Americas, they can adjust to seasonal change. Some of the animals, like the macaws, for example, the large parrots, we have to put indoors at night, and they have heaters and heat lamps and things to keep them warm, and even amongst those species, some fare better than others. The green-winged macaws tend to be a little bit hardier and can stay out in slightly more extreme temperatures.
I know that the zoo here is undergoing some changes. I know recently you launched a new exhibit. It was an Australian-themed exhibit. And then also there's the construction of a new hospital area.
Well, with the Australian Outback exhibit or area of the zoo, that was just phase one that we have so far with the wallabies. We hope to develop phase two and phase three. Phase two will incorporate expanding the exhibit and adding a water feature. But in phase one, we had to focus on planning for those future expansions and accommodating additional species to the wallabies. So we have fancy, I guess, holding areas for them with modern heaters and climate control, so that when we open the aviary, and we're not 100%, but we may be getting emu and black swan in that exhibit as well, we would have accommodations for them. The wallabies were a pretty funny example, though. We had a very nice holding area designed and built for them that stayed very, very warm. And about 2 weeks after we got them, the temperature dropped to about 7 degrees for a few days, and they stayed outside.
Wow.
They're very cold weather hardy, which we were familiar with, but not quite to that extreme. So 7, they're outside playing, and then a few weeks later it was 70, and they were laying around like they didn't want to do anything.
Right.
So the animals can surprise you, but the animal hospital that you mentioned is something that we hope will not necessarily solve a lot of problems, but make life a lot better for the animals that we have, as well as additional animals that we may have coming in. Right now, in this small room, you can't imagine housing something like a jaguar if it had a medical issue, or a much larger animal that was sensitive to the cold weather. With this new animal hospital, we'll have a variety of different types of holding areas so that it can accommodate to them and all their needs for different species.
Yeah. Once the hospital is completed, and the fact that you can do so much more for these animals and for this facility because you have that, is that really a game changer as far as the future of what's at the zoo and the growth of the zoo, not only just in the number of animals, but the types of exhibits that you can feature?
We really hope so. We have some geographical constraints, so realistically the possibilities of the zoo expanding physically or geographically are low, but we have a lot of areas within the zoo that we would like to see developed, new exhibits and new species, and with the animal hospital, that would allow us a wider variety of choice of species that we could bring into the zoo.
That was Caleb Oliver, one of the zookeepers at the Salisbury Zoo. You can find more information about the animals and the zoo's exhibits at our website, wamucoast.org. I'm Brian Russo, and you're listening to Coastal Connection.